This is Sophia.
And I'm Victoria.
You're listening to It's All History to Me, Auburn's History Radio Hour at 8 a.m. on Thursdays. Each week, we will interview a history professional with the theme of bridging the past and present.
Let's get started.
I am in a conventional dither with a conventional star in my eye. And you will note there's a lump in my throat when I speak of that wonderful guy.
Good morning and welcome back to It's All History to Me. This morning we are joined by Dr. Foridori from Auburn University's College of Veterinary Medicine. Dr. Foridori joined Auburn University faculty in 2010. Dr. Foridori received a BS degree from Muskingum University in New Concord, Ohio, and a PhD from the University of Cincinnati College of Medicine. Dr. Foridori continued his training as a postdoctoral fellow at Colorado State University College of Veterinary Medicine and in Biomedical Sciences. Before joining the faculty at Auburn, Dr. Foridori was a research assistant professor at the University of Arizona College of Medicine, Phoenix. Dr. Foridori's research focuses on the neuroendocrine control of reproduction. Thank you so much for joining us this morning, Dr. Foridori.
Thank you, Sophia and Victoria. I really appreciate this opportunity to talk to you guys, but also to sort of branch out. I know this is your last episode of the season, so I really appreciate this opportunity.
Yeah, absolutely. Excited to have you on.
Yeah. Can you briefly explain what your research is for our listeners?
Okay, I'll try to keep it short, even though my students say I'm incapable of doing that. As you mentioned, I study the neuroendocrine control of reproduction. And what does that mean? Neuro means the brain, and endocrine meaning any substance produced by any tissue in the body that can float around in the blood. So it's neuroendocrine. So these are specialized neurons that, yes, talk to other neurons, like in a neural network of circuitry, but they also communicate directly into the bloodstream. So they produce proteins that are secreted or hormones that are secreted out into the blood, so they're endocrine. But particularly, we focus on a very unique group of neurons. I think they're unique because I've spent 30 years studying them, that they control all aspects of your reproduction. And they're called gonadotropin-releasing hormone neurons. I know that's a lot to say, but so we abbreviate them GnRH cells. Why are they so unique? There's only, you have about 10 billion neurons in your brain. Roughly, it's controversial, as some things are, roughly about 800 to 2,000 of those 10 billion neurons are made up of these GnRH neurons. The other unique aspect of them is they are not born in your brain. They, during development in an embryonic stage, they are born in your nose, outside your central nervous system, and they crawl into your brain. They migrate into your brain, right? And if they don't migrate, they migrate into your brain, and then they sort of spread out, not in any one spot, but in just a general area of your brain called the hypothalamus. And then they connect to that vasculature to be an endocrine sort of tissue. If something goes wrong and they don't migrate through, or if they are dysregulated, you never go through puberty. You never reproduce. And it's these few cells that'll do this. So we, and the other interesting thing about them, among many, is once they reach their final destination, they crawl into your brain and send axons and dendrites into different regions, they go to sleep. And they just sit there until you're ready to reinitialize them during puberty. And that's why you have secondary sexual characteristics at puberty, is because these neurons get active again. They wake up. So our research is trying to figure out how these really unique neurons work, what controls their migration, what controls when they go to sleep and when they wake up. Another aspect of this is seasonality. We're not seasonal animals, but many of the food animals that we interact with, such as sheep, horses, all rodents, they will only be reproductively viable during certain day lengths. And these neurons know what time of day, what time of season it is, and so they will shut down. That way, you only, again, this is a springtime, you only have lambs delivered in the springtime when the weather is nicer, when there's the most food available. Otherwise, you wouldn't want a lamb to be born in the wintertime when there's no way that they would survive that endurance. So we study how these GnRH neurons are regulated, mainly, in different aspects about how they know what time of day it is, how much food an animal has, but also what happens when outside insults come into play. So we also study what are called endocrine disruptive chemicals, herbicides, toxins that we as humans have put out into the environment and then come back to us and disrupt this normal system. So we kind of, on multiple aspects, study those regulations of these GnRH neurons.
Wow. That's so interesting.
We think so.
Yeah, yeah. So what led you to this specific research interest?
Great teachers. I know it, from your previous guests, it's sort of a revolving theme that we're all sort of inspired one way or another, somewhere along the line, by great teachers. Mm-hmm. I always was interested in science and biology, but I had no idea where to take that. I was the first person in my family ever to go to college, so I didn't know sort of the things you could do. I didn't know you could just be a scientist. Mm-hmm. I know we all see it on television and in movies, but I didn't. That was a foreign idea. I didn't know a scientist per se. And I went to a small liberal arts school in southeastern Ohio, Go Muskies. And they had a neuroscience program that they had just started and filled with fantastic professors and instructors who really inspired me to say, hey, this is what I want to do.
Wow.
Yeah. How does your research process mirror the work of historians?
We walk hand in hand. This is one of the things that when we get new students, we start to write papers, because again, we have these, we hopefully will have hypothesis driven research, meaning we have supportive data that suggests a theory that we sort of postulate into our hypothesis, and then we design an experiment to test that hypothesis. And we get results one way or the other that supports or refutes that hypothesis. But the overall arch of all of our research is publication, is to let everyone else in the world know what we found.
Right.
Whether it was groundbreaking or, you know, nothing to really speak of, you need to publish. Otherwise, what you did was really worthless. It really doesn't help the community and society as a whole. So it's all about publication. So what does that mean as a historian is, and what I try to convey to my students is, when you write your paper up and your findings, you become a historian. Mm. You have to put your findings in the context. You were never the first person to have this related idea. Again, yes, there is novelty, and we look for innovation, but everything we do is supported by previous work. And so you have to scour the previous publications and literature and put your new findings in context. Does it refute it? Does it support it? And you have to delve into each of those and not just read the abstract, and understand all the parameters, all the dosage, all the interpretations, what metrics did they use? And so you become a mini historian. Now, I will tell you, to be fair, our history investigation is much easier than you guys' one, because we have a common database and a format, Medline PubMed, that is run by the National Institute of Health, that allows us to look at just about, again, not every paper that's ever been published or released is all been digitized, but certainly in the modern age, we don't have to go through, you know, microfilm and read newspapers from the 1912s to discoveries, but we do have to put our findings in context in that historical pastime to make it make sense, and by way, to give credit to who have come before us and done these other groundbreaking works.
Oh, yeah. Those are great points, and definitely framing it in a way that makes a lot of sense that I hadn't thought about before, how the two really do connect very well. Okay. What do you hope will be the result of your research?
Overall, again, we have hopefully multiple endpoints. One is just a better understanding of reproduction as a whole, just as a basic scientist. Like, again, how all vertebrates have these GnRH neurons, and they actually have all of them, with a few exceptions, have the exact same. This is only this GnRH gonadotropin releasing hormone peptide is only 10 amino acids long, mm-hmm. and it's the same for every vertebrate except for the rainbow trout and the sea lamprey has one amino acid different for some reason. But every other vertebrate has this exact same thing. So there's sort of this conservation of this structure, and it's how it's done. So it's just this basic understanding of how reproduction works. But more over and above that is human health. Helping people who have infertility issues, helping people who have disorders such as polycystic ovary syndrome or endometriosis. These are things that are controlled by your reproductive system that can have profound impact on your daily life. Mm. And then, as previous guests have told you, Auburn University is a land-grant university. We're here to help the people of Alabama in all facets, whether it be health, but also in food animal production. Mm-hmm. And one of the struggles and challenges we have moving forward is feeding a growing population during a time of climate change. And so if we can increase reproductive efficiency by just 1%, 2%, oh, yeah, we can feed the world. Mm-hmm. So all that put together, we hope to, yes, have a better basic understanding of the concepts, help in human health, but also increase animal production.
Wow, yeah.
What distinguishes STEM research from the work being done in the humanities?
I'm sorry, can you say that again?
What distinguishes STEM research from the work being done in the humanities?
I'm probably going to shortchange on both sides, but the big one is the ability for experimentation, for direct experimentation. Again, you guys could probably correct me. There are times I we'll talk more about it in a minute. I'm a huge fan of history, and I love the ones where they do experimental research, saying this is how the heads of Easter Island were placed there. This is how Stonehenge was made. One of my favorites is one: how do they build the Great Pyramids with these huge land ramps? So yes, there is experimentation in history, but for the most part, in the STEM, it's basic hypothesis-driven experimental research. Until we build a time machine, we don't know what would truly have been the effect if Abraham Lincoln hadn't been assassinated in the results of Reconstruction. We can't go back and save him and see what the results would be. Mm-hmm. That's really the big difference.
Good points. Maybe one day there'll be a time machine.
Heaven help us if that actually happens.
Yeah, that's true.
All right. For our last question of this segment, how would you say your work ties into our theme this semester of bridging the past and present?
It very much does. I know I'm self-aggrandizing, and please forgive me. I'm not comparing myself to Isaac Newton, but Isaac Newton has this famous quote. He says, "If I have seen further than others, it is by standing on the shoulders of giants." What does that mean? It's the people who came before us in biomedical sciences that allow us to do what we're doing now. So it is it's a single line and a bridge between the past and the present.
Yeah, great answer.
We're going to take an ad break, but we'll see you in 2 minutes.
Good morning, and welcome back to It's All History to Me. This morning, Sophia and I are joined by Dr. Foradori from the College of Veterinary Medicine here at Auburn University. So, as we mentioned at the top of the hour, Dr. Foradori's research really focuses on the neuroendocrine control of reproduction. So, talking about this more, do you see a lot of crossover between the work done within your college and the work being done in the College of Liberal Arts and the History Department in particular?
Yes, definitely. We spoke earlier about one of the facets of my work is looking at the effects on the neuron control of reproduction by environmental contaminants, toxins. Mainly we work with a herbicide called atrazine, which is a ubiquitous, it's the second most commonly used herbicide in the United States. But it's the most common herbicide found in our water supply. We also do work with lead and its effect on reproduction. And there are people in my department who work with bisphenol A and forever chemicals, which are really pressing now as well, and how they affect reproduction and their end control. What does that have to do with the history department? Multiple faculty members study the effects historical inequality on certain regions of the South, but particularly Alabama, particularly Dr. Carter, Dr. Brooks, Dr. Gaddis, that these are systemic cultural underpinnings on inequity and poverty. So what does that mean for us? And again, I'm using generalization. There's always exceptions to the rule. But the most contaminated water sources in Alabama runs along the Black Belt. Those are the you're more likely to have these contaminants in water sources along those lines. And those historians have shown why that is. And so they go hand in hand, understanding about why that pollution might be there, how we might remediate it, and where should we target interventions to mediate those effects.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think there's a lot of like collaboration available within STEM and the humanities. Like last semester, we did an episode with Dr. Haas, who studies early modern amputees, and she was working with a professor with the mechanical engineering department to reconstruct and like 3D print what one would have looked like, so that way it could be a model for like future instruction and like her presentations and things like that.
Yeah.
Oh, that's fantastic. And again, we are encouraged as faculty to sort of collaborate across multiple milieus, as it were, across campus, whether it be in STEM or liberal arts, because, again, you can synergize and make very unique, creative outcomes from it.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I completely agree. And the university is such a great space to get to do that, too, since everybody's just a couple feet away from one another, that you can just walk across campus and go from the humanities world to the STEM world.
And that's very true. I will say the College of Veterinary Medicine is just off campus, about a quarter of a mile, just far enough so we don't have to worry about parking. So
nice.
I appreciate that there is some distance, but Tiger Transit makes it really easy.
Yeah. Absolutely. Okay, so digging in more for this segment, we want to talk about the advantages behind having the well-rounded scholars in academia by talking to you more about your interests outside the laboratory, too. So why is it important that professionals have varying interests and a willingness to explore topics outside their primary fields of study?
To boil it down, I truly believe it's creativity. Now, as we've talked about earlier, I went to a very small liberal arts school, and again, it was mandated, similar to what the core courses hope to do here at Auburn. I've been on the core curriculum committee in the past, that as a faculty here at Auburn, that we encourage and mandate that students take a well-rounded core courses. Why would we want to do that? It's no universities or institution of higher education is, yes, you there are all different things you can learn at the university. But we're not, and again, take advantage of that as the much you possibly can, because it's an opportunity that you'll never get in the rest of your life to have this much expertise and knowledge being given to you and that you can interact with as well. It's not just looking at a screen and absorbing it. It is interacting with those people. But more importantly, any higher institute of higher education that strives for greatness should not be essentially just here to tell you what to think. It's tell you how to think. Mm-hmm. So as you move forward, you know to look at all aspects of an issue from different perspectives, to understand where to find and how to critique sources where you should get new information from, right? And by looking at that sort of from a issue from all aspects, you're inspired to be more creative. And that's how innovation happens. That's how new ideas come about. And so having this not just be focused on, and again, I don't want to criticize any of my colleagues. I'm just using it as an example. You can looking at one ion channel for 20 years and looking at just different aspects of that ion channel is great, and we need it for drug discovery and what have you. But having a well-rounded how that ion channel fits into that neuron, into that nucleus and how it interacts with the animal's behavior, as we go further and further out, and how that can have a societal effect, those are the sort of big picture collaborative ideas that we need. And we can only do that if we have multiple avenues to explore.
Yeah, that makes sense. And tying back into that land grant purpose,
yes,
too. Yeah, absolutely.
Do you think that the undergraduate students who eventually join the College of Veterinary Medicine benefit from having a well-rounded education, in which case they must take core classes outside of their like STEM focus?
Definitely. And this gives me a great opportunity to plug our new undergraduate major, our Public and One Health. I'm not involved in this, but it's certainly several of my colleagues at the College of Veterinary Medicine have pushed for over the past four, five plus years. And it, I think it, it is, it has been a long time minor, but I think, and again, someone's going to probably call in and correct me, this fall it goes into full effect as a new major here at Public and One Health. So we don't have a lot of experience with that, but whether it is undergraduate, graduate students, or our professional student, our veterinary students, yes, we are in different aspects of each. Yes, they are highly encouraged to do what we were just talking about, have a well-rounded background. But particularly, you can imagine, in public health, yes, you're going to have to know a whole lot about the science. You're going to have to know a lot about the sociology, the psychology of all aspects of public health. So yes, it'll be a mainstay of our core curriculum.
Yeah, yeah. Is there any non-STEM class you would particularly, I guess, highly encourage or suggest that your undergraduates take or consider looking into?
Any course, and history courses do a great job of this, is where you write. I'm sure you guys have heard from multiple educators is that that's the one thing we need to do more of because, yes, there are well, I'll actually answer this by answering two questions. And I'll make it about myself. It's writing, right, whether it be history, English, whatever. And I would tell them, and I always have my students are encouraged to this, anything where you have to get up in front of people, whether that be a history class, a theater class, a communications class, because again, biomedical sciences, it's about all these things, but it's also about communicating your results.
Right.
You need to be a good writer. You need to be a good speaker to let people know you might make the greatest discovery since sliced bread, but if you're not able to distribute that out in a cognitive, in a cogent way, then no one's going to know about it. Mm-hmm. And so you've, again, wasted your time because you can't distribute that information in a really good way.
That makes sense. All interconnected.
Yes.
I have like a question that you mentioned like a little bit earlier that's you might not know the answer to. Why is the public health major in the College of Veterinary Medicine as opposed to like I would assume it would be in like COSAM under like the biomedical sciences department?
Yeah, I just thought again I don't know to answer your question fully. I think there was just an opportunity and there was a potential void that several of the faculty members in the College of Veterinary Medicine saw it. I will say most of this work stems from great educators and researchers from our pathobiology department. What does that mean? Veterinarians are very often the first line of defense when it comes to public health. And again, you may or may not be paying attention, but bird flu is a big, big, big issue right now that is systemic problem, but is that will affect human health, but also our food availability. So they were well positioned to sort of address these issues in a broader fact. It's public health and one health. One health meaning what affects our animal companions affects us, whether they be food animal or your cats or dogs or fish. They are all interlinked. We are not isolated onto ourselves. So they felt they were really well suited, and the Board of Trustees agreed, and they said, hey, this is an area that needs support in our undergraduate education.
That's awesome. It makes a lot of sense, too, now that you're saying that about how it crosses over from the animal world to the human world and all of that.
Yep.
Yeah, we're going to take an ad break, but we'll see you in 2 minutes. Good morning, and welcome back to It's All History to Me. This morning, we are joined by Dr. Foradori from the Auburn University College of Veterinary Medicine. To start off this next segment, what era of history are you most interested in?
Okay, I'm going to be so pedantic here that it's World War II, but so many people are, mainly because, but I love all history, but anytime, it'll be World War II just and the Cold War that came after it just brings so much drama and so many sort of what ifs, you know, what if, because there were so many pinnacle points and individuals involved that it allows your imagination to sort of run away. And again, yeah. Such a grand scale and such a on a world level, hence mm-hmm. its name. It just brings so much drama to it. But, yeah, I know it's a common answer, but, yeah, World War II.
Yeah. Was there a specific moment or character, I guess, in that sort of era that sparked your interest?
It changes all the time, I guess, and I think I'm preaching to the choir in the sense that, you know, you stumble upon a new person or a new story, and you're like, wow, that's really, really cool.
Yeah.
But and currently, it would be Dwight Eisenhower. It's somewhat happened sort of more organically that – not that I didn't know about Dwight Eisenhower, but the occurrences that have happened in his life, the responsibilities that have – and I'll say this in revolving to museums because that's where my biggest – that and books. If you go to the D-Day Museum in New Orleans, which, again, I highly recommend if you haven't been there, to all your listeners – there's a letter that Dwight Eisenhower wrote in response to if the D-Day invasion was a failure. Mm. And it really showed you his empathy and his understanding of what was going on. That if we failed here, and it coincided with his letter of resignation. So if he knew if it didn't work, because it was all his really, he was the one saying this is when we're doing this is how we're doing it. And it showed his empathy. And then you jump ahead, all right, and go to the Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C. And again, highly recommended. It's a very powerful museum. There is an interview there with him, recording, essentially stating when the concentration camps were liberated, he made sure that all the surrounding communities in whether it be in Germany or one of the allied countries, were forced to go through it so they could never say never. And he had film crews and he had his soldiers go through these concentration camps because he knew, he was present to the idea, there would be a day people were going to deny that this happened. And he wanted as many people to witness. So he had that forethought. Again, he had empathy, knowing that if he failed, what it would mean to the world, but all those men he was sending in to the D-Day invasion. And then to know that he could tell the future. He could say, there will be a day that people were going to deny that this atrocity happened. Again, move forward in time. He becomes president. Again, there was a story that Truman, who was a Democrat, was willing to not run for re-election if Eisenhower were going on the ticket. But Eisenhower said no because he was not a New Deal guy. He believed in small government. So he ran for on the Republican ticket and won. And what does he do with his, you know, didn't like the New Deal? He passed the interstate bill that allowed – it was a huge, huge governmental infrastructure bill that allowed us to all travel on the interstates, right. Good or bad. Again, there's these contradictions to all historical figures. He was instrumental in integrating the military. But yet – and when he – became president, he didn't push civil rights and was always said, wait, don't go too fast. And as we all know, justice delayed is justice denied. He did appoint judges who were, you know, receptive to the idea of civil rights, and he did pass a few civil rights bills, but he was always like, no, don't go too fast. And at the same time, his final sort of prescient moment is he was the one who coined this military-industrial complex. Mm. Knowing, again, he was a military guy. He believed in defense, of course, right? But he saw what was coming. It was one of his last speeches as president or surrounding there that said, hey, I see this coming. Again, good or bad, we have a lot of political sway towards this huge industrial complex that can sort of move the country in different directions. Mm-hmm. And so there's all these sort of interplay, all the decisions he had to make. Those are the people in history that I find so, so, so fascinating. Yeah. That they are there at these pinnacle points that they have to make a decision
right.
on the fly, and it can change the world forever.
Yeah.
On that topic, and again, this is why I bring this up, is great historians. There's a lot of great biographies on Eisenhower. I'd recommend Eisenhower in War and Peace by Gene Smith. Really, really good book. So, but I, again, fascinating stories and fascinating person.
Absolutely. The power of a charismatic leader, for sure.
Yes.
What historical periods or figures do you find that influence your current work and research?
Okay. You can pull me back if I go too long. Because there's I guess I told you, research is about history. It's about how your work connects to others. And there are certain people in history, in neuroscience particularly, or neuroendocrinology, that have been pinnacle to my work, but also have sort of used as life lessons, right? So there's this guy in the I'm going to get my dates wrong. Sorry, my high school and college professors. I was never good with dates. But it was around the 1830s. There was this guy from Spain called Rami Cajal, right? And again, fascinating life. He was born in Spain, but he fought in the 10-year war for Cuban independence, almost died twice. He was a medic there, but he returned to Spain and got a position at the University of Barcelona. And again, something you people don't appreciate, there was the center of the universe of all research during the mid to late 1800s was London, Paris, maybe Brussels, maybe Berlin, but not Barcelona. Nobody, it was a backwater, rural kind of place, right? And he was fascinated by neuroscience, right? And how the brain works. And at the time, there was a controversy about, is it single neurons or are they actually connected, physically connected to each other, meaning there's no distinction between the cell, the neuron that is in your hand that goes up to your brain, that they're actually not just close contact but connected. And it was a big deal, right? It was called the neuron doctrine, right? Anyway. He develops or uses these stains to identify different neurons in the body or in the brain. And there's no cameras, right? There is photography at this time in the 1800s, but not anything that's connected to a microscope that he had. He made these beautiful images, drawings that to this day are indistinguishable from what you would take a picture of. He was
wow.
that good.
Wow.
And he went on to win the Nobel Prize and become the father of neuroscience. Even to this day, a colleague of mine has a print, an original print of his. It was my mentor when I was a graduate school, and I would just sit there and stare at it because it was just amazing. And then three other stories, and they're all connected. I'll be quick, I promise. They're all women, but the Rosalind Yalo, all right, she was this born in New York, and we jumped ahead about 50 years, about the 1920s, right? And she loved physics, loved chemistry, went to Hunter College. Hunter College is a great school, but at the time it was an all-women school, and you went there to become a teacher. You were becoming an elementary school teacher. That was where women really had to go, right? But Rosalind was like, no, I want to be a physicist. And she found the only place she could find to go to graduate school was the University of Illinois, and went there and did amazing work, stellar stuff. And then she wanted to get a faculty position somewhere to be a physicist, and no one would hire her.
Wow.
So she went back to Hunter College to become a teacher of teachers, right? But she would not give up, right? And she started volunteering at the local VA hospital to use, at the time, radioisotopes were really big. It was, around World War II. And, you know, better living through radioactivity was the sort of the day, the coin of the day. But she did use radioisotopes to develop a new assay for developing, for essentially assaying or measuring all sorts of things in the blood, right? You could use it for anything, but she used it for, to, that's what the VA was interested in. And it was called radioimmunoassay, all right? And in a collaboration, she used this, a guy used this radioimmunoassay. It's called Roger Guillon. And I'm sorry if I'm messing up his name. He's French. He discovered GnRH using Rosalind's technique. And together, they won the Nobel Prize for Medicine. And so, again, perseverance, being a backwater researcher like Rami Kahal and doing amazing work, not having all the bells and whistles, but through perseverance and ingenuity, figuring out ways to answer a question. And then we cut to Rosalind Yalo, who, again, not allowed to interact, but collaborated with others and changed the world. But more importantly, this is my favorite part of the story. So Rosalind's back at Hunter College. During the day, she's teaching women who are going to mostly go on to be teachers. At night, she's volunteering, not paid, to do Nobel Prize winning work, right? Mm-hmm. One of the women that she teaches at Hunter College is, her name is Millie Dresselhaus, right? I mean, you may or may not know her. Millie, like Rosalind, was sort of put in Hunter College and said, just become a teacher, right? And she was getting a lot of pressure to do that because that was the one thing that women were really allowed to do. Mm-hmm. And she had Rosalind as a teacher, and Rosalind said, no, you're special. You can do whatever you want. You do what, you know, become a scientist. Mm-hmm. And she pushed Millie to become a scientist, and Millie did, and went on to become what is referred to as the queen of carbon. Where she became a physicist, chemist, and revolutionized the way we understand how molecules interact and connect to each other. Again, so amazing story. So, and I take from each of these, yes, Rosalind was this amazing researcher who persevered to go past what she, you know, the boundaries that were put in front of her. At the same time, she was a great educator that inspired students. And again, I'm not comparing myself to Isaac Newton. I'm not comparing myself to Rosalind. But those are the things that I take from me. Like, hey, yeah. I can be a great researcher and I can discover great things, but I can also hopefully inspire the next generation to do more than they had initially thought they could.
Yeah. Oh, that's awesome. And so many great stories, too. Yeah. Fun people to look at from history. Okay. So let's see. Another question. What can history teach students who tend to favor STEM classes, in your opinion?
Again, I think it's about creativity to know and context. How were your innovations, discoveries, how are they going to fit into the broader world, the broader community, and history as a whole? Doing things, you know, the society or culture, pop culture sort of has this mad scientist and they, you know, working with beakers and colored liquids and boiling things and never seeing the light of day. But everything that we do, as we talked about so many times during today's discussion, is interconnected. Mm-hmm. No person is an island. And so you have to be able to interact with those other people. And knowing the history, knowing the culture that maybe your discovery can make huge inroads or is very important. Very important.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Why is it important that academics and people in general have wide-spanning interests that cross disciplines?
On the same, again, it harkens back to sparking innovation and understanding context. We've talked so much about different historical events, but trying to put things, even as a historian, where you're interested in certain topics, it's really important to understand the scientific innovation at that time. Why were the Wright brothers developing flight at that time? Was it because everyone before them was just ignorant and didn't want to do it? No, it was because The Telegraph and newspapers sort of spurred on this sort of drive for flight. The physics of lift were starting to be better understood. And most importantly, the materials that were available became, you know, available to them to create lift with enough rigidity but flexibility not to break. Again, my kids probably hate this story now. One of my favorite fun facts is at the top of the Washington Monument, there is a pyramid of 100 ounces of pure aluminum. It's at the top of this obelisk is a pyramid of a solid block of aluminum. And you're like, why is that there? Why is that? And why was that put there when it was finished, what, in 1880 something? It's because at the time, it was the most precious metal, because it was sort of newly discovered and it had these really interesting flexibility things, but it was really hard to refine. It was more precious than gold. And it was the United States, by putting this huge block, 100 ounces, on the top of this monument to our first president, telling the world, look at us. Look how awesome the United States of America is, because we have this 100 ounces of aluminum.
Wow.
It's the biggest thing. And it's, by the way, I think it's probably worth $20 now because we've kind of, but at the time, and so you have to put what you've learned in context.
Yeah.
And that time, the science and innovation was at a point where 100 ounces of aluminum was amazing that we were able to do that. It was a humongous feat to do it. And so having this well-rounded idea gives you context and innovation on each of those.
Yeah, and certainly ties into bridging the past and the present.
Oh, yes, for sure.
Yeah, we're going to take our last ad break of the hour, but we'll see you in 2 minutes.
Hey, Dr. Phil here. I help people solve difficult and trying personal problems every day on my TV show, but there's one problem that just got me stuck. Childhood hunger.
I do appreciate, because I've listened to all of your other, that very often your professors do not know the answers.
Yeah. When we first started, a lot of them would ask to, like, see the questions, the answers that we found. They're like,
I was tempted to text for VLS, like, hey, what are you going to ask?
Yeah.
Luckily, the Feeding America network of good people is out there collecting surplus food.
Yes, they have. I particularly like the guy, there were... I love the interviews where they just drop things, and you guys don't have time to follow up everything. But I can't remember which guy. He did the Victorian Ages, was it? Yeah, and he goes, you guys ask him, what is it also known as? And it was the Second Golden Age or something. I can't remember. But Yeah, that's right. He goes, I'm going to have to bring up that question at the Midwest Victorian conference.
Yeah.
I was like, wait, there's a Midwest
Victorian
conference? I want to know more about that.
That's so true. Yeah, that's a
I was
good
just
point.
Like, whoa, what is that?
Yeah. It is kind of crazy how, like, these different groups of people form, and then they're just like, I'm going to this conference for, like, this obscure. It's like,
that's a really niche thing.
Yeah.
Midwest, really. It's not even the national.
Right.
In the Army National Guard.
Again, I know I keep harking back to it, but your
Weagle
history guy, he was like, there was a conference of all the engineering magazines.
Yeah, and that's how he
started. Whoa, that is weird.
Yeah, how'd he get there?
Serving part-time in the Army National Guard instills pride that you and your family will share. Visit NationalGuard.com to learn more about part-time service. Sponsored by the Alabama Army National Guard. Aired by the Alabama Broadcasters Association and this station.
Yep.
Yeah.
I do appreciate the ones who are honest when you bring up their book. Like, I tried to find it where you could buy it. You can't buy it.
Welcome back to It's All History to Me. We're about to finish up our segment with our typical trivia questions. So a little birdie told us that you're a big Star Trek fan. So those are our trivia question theme of the hour. So for our first question, how many episodes of Star Trek The Next Generation were there?
Well, that's not fair. this was back when... you had a lot of episodes per season, like 20-something, and I think they had I'm going to say 141.
That's pretty close. It's 178.
Oh, I was off a season or so. Okay.
Yeah. That's impressive, though. Okay, our next question. What was the name of the character who briefly replaced Dr. Crusher as the Enterprise's chief medical officer?
That's Dr. Pulaski.
Yeah.
The Bane, it's funny how things have changed. Like, for your listeners who probably don't know anything about this, Star Trek Next Generation came out in 1989, and the internet wasn't around, but there was still pockets of, and it was Trekkies, so they are very vocal. And in the second season, this wonderful actress came on who I think hated her time on the show because she wasn't really into the sort of sci-fi aspect of it. But yeah, she was a huge prickly point for a lot of people hate her, a lot of people love her.
Huh.
But Dr. Pulaski, Dr. Kate Pulaski, I believe it was. But I got one. Sweet.
Woo.
Yeah. For a second to last question of the hour, why is it important that we study history?
Other than it being fun and it interesting on itself, I'm going to be really rote here, is to not make the same mistakes. I mean, it's a saying for a reason that if we don't understand history, we're doomed to repeat the mistakes that have come in the past. And again, for biomedical sciences, that's really, really important. You're dealing with really limited resources. Sometimes we just have to repeat things because to prove and to support what has come before. But you certainly don't want to take a whole lot of time and resources away from your projects when there were four papers out there that you never saw, that you didn't know existed, and you're just doing it again and showing that it's still not going to work. Mm-hmm. So it's really, really important, all aspects of history, for us to understand and for us to grow as a culture and as individuals.
Yeah, absolutely. And for our final question of our hour, our episode today, and our third season, what advice do you have for current and future students of history, but then also kind of branching that out, biomedical sciences or veterinary medicine?
For sure. It comes down to one thing, perseverance. Mm-hmm. It is so, so difficult. All of these avenues of scholarship can be very, very frustrating. And as with everything, life can get you down. But to always give yourself a little bit of grace to step back and say, that is on that same idea about history. Mm-hmm. When you start looking at historical figures, no matter where they are, but particularly in biomedical sciences, you see their flaws. Mm. You see that they got a C in chemistry when they were in college. And you realize that even though we now put them up on huge pedestals, mm-hmm. that they are flawed individuals on so many different ways. You know, maybe they've been married six times. Maybe they had really weird ideas about, you know, culture. And we see that they are flawed. Mm. And I think that actually helps with that sort of perseverance to understand that you're not perfect and you don't need to be perfect because the people that came before you that did what we perceive as great things weren't perfect either.
Yeah.
To just persevere and to keep trying. Yeah. If it's something that gives you joy, it doesn't have to be joyful every day, but keep going.
That's good advice.
So to end our hour, we have some thank yous. Thank you so much, Dr. Foradori, for joining us this morning. We really appreciate it. Thank you to the History Department and our faculty advisor, Dr. Schultz, for their time and their support. We really appreciate it. Thank you for Weagle for our airtime and their continued support. We really appreciate it. And lastly, thank you to our listeners for listening in today and this entire season. We truly couldn't do this without you. And with that, we finish up our third season, and we'll see you in August.
See you in August.
You've been listening to It's All History to Me, the show dedicated to exploring the people, places, and ideas of our past. Be sure to tune in next Thursday at 8 a.m. for more. But for now, keep it here on Weagle 91.1.
See you next time!